Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to another episode of your favorite hockey and sporting podcast, Hockey, the Podcast. The name says it all, from east to south to north to west and west. Incidentally, was our very last episode where we featured the likes of Ricky West, all sides of him. This time around, we're going elsewhere, but still remaining within the borders of South Africa. That, I think, actually, I'm not even too sure, but one thing I am sure of is that running alongside me, as always, is my partner in crime, Tyron Jabu Barnard. How are you, Ty?
Yeah, Derek, let me try and start with a little bit more voice. Yeah, it's always good to chat, and we had a week off, a chance to rest our voices, although we were busy with quizzes. But we decided to have a week off because certain people, not our current guest, weren't available. So,
and we had to
trying to rush something in,
and we had to play a lot of golf.
I mean, you have played a little bit more than me lately, but I am headed to Mpumalanga next week to take on the jewel of most people's bucket list.
Is there a golf course down there?
Little one. You may not have heard of it. It's called a little mashy course called Leopard Creek.
Oh man, jeez, I am jealous. So yeah, you certainly need needed the week off to recharge your batteries and hopefully get your handicap up, maybe as you go down to Mpumalanga to take that on. But we're not talking golf, of course. We are talking hockey. I mentioned Ricky West. That was our last guest, episode 58. We're now going on to episode 59, and once again, Ty, you brought on a cracker.
Yeah, and it's if I'm correct, is it our first completed pair of brothers?
It could be. You know what else I was thinking about is that the surname has actually featured quite often on the show, and not necessarily as relatives.
No, of course not. But it is, we've had Ian Evans, or good old one, as he is affectionately known on the show. And today we go to his brother, none other than Steve Evans, better known as Sevens, a man with 96, caps for South Africa, an Olympian playing in the Athens Olympics, and of course, probably one of the greatest hockey minds that you will ever meet. So I think that's probably not even enough justice can do for our guest today, but welcome, Sevens.
Thanks, Jabu. Yeah, thanks, man. I think those are very kind words there to start off with. Certainly hockey's been a big part of the Evans family, and I'm sure we'll get right into it in just a moment.
Well, I mean, let's dive right in. I mean, let's start with the playing side of stuff, Sevens. I mean, you've been involved around the South African squad as early as 1994. You played 96 games, which ultimately culminated in the Athens Olympics, which you went to with your brother, which must have been an amazing thing. I mean, what are the standout memories from you in your playing time for South Africa?
Yeah, sure, Jabu. I mean, I think like every athlete, in fact, and I was just sharing this with one of the schools that I was asked to speak at recently, and I was just telling the kids that, you know, in like life, it's a journey, and it's not always plain sailing. So it's obviously lots of ups and downs through a career. In the hockey context, for me, I mean, I think if I rewind right back to the very, very early days, having been born effectively into the hockey family, you know, my first memories were pretty much, playing on the lawn with my dad and my brothers. And coincidentally, because my folks had been in the UK during the 70s, and my dad had played with and at Hounslow Hockey Club for many, many, many years with a number of different GB internationals and Olympians. we had this very strong connection, and one of those friends of his, a guy by the name of Suti Kaha, of Indian origin with the most incredible stick skills and hands that you've ever seen. I do have this really, you know, fond memory of myself and my two brothers trying to tackle Suti as he just sort of dribbled in and around us on the back lawn. But through the years and sort of, you know, fast forwarding through mini hockey and schools representing Maritzburg College and being trained under Mike Bechet through the SA schools sort of process, there were a number of great like hockey highlights within that. But as you ask, sort of, you know, what were the key standouts you know, during my career. And I think absolutely, initially I was selected as part of the 1994 World Cup squad, which was fairly momentous, just in the context of it was, you know, the first time that South Africa would compete in the World Cup, after many years of isolation. And another sort of, I suppose, quite momentous hockey experience that was linked to this and also forms part of the journey was when Jock Coombs put together a touring group where we went in 1992 to the Barcelona Olympics to watch. So he put together an under 16 development squad and under 19 development squad. A handful of under 21s came along and then a whole lot of coaches. We stayed in this youth hostel and we played a couple of games and we trained every day up at Club Agora. We watched all these games and we had this exposure and this touch point to international hockey. So that, you know, that in itself was an experience. But 94, I just missed out on the team. I remember also distinctly getting totally scribbled by Ali Fredericks. You know, when Gavin Featherston asked us to do sort of one versus ones, 1v1s, and anyway, missed out on the actual on going to the 94 World Cup, missed out on Atlanta. Again, you know, Featherston and myself never really got on 100%, and it was a bit of an uphill period. And then got my first cap for the South African team in India under Giles Bonnet, 96. And then, yeah, again, missed out on the 98 Commonwealth Games, unfortunately, and World Cup team, but carried on, got it back in the squad. Then there was a great sort of life experience that I'd love to share with you around the Sydney Olympics, which was when Samram Sammy had decided that our team, despite qualifying, did not meet the requirements that SASCOC had set at the time or it was Knox actually at that time for the team to participate. And I ended up actually going over. I got involved as a volunteer, and actually sat on the FIH table for the gold medal match. So, I still had this epic experience, which we can chat a bit more about if people are interested. And then, again, despite that disappointment, we, you know, carried on still accumulating test caps, having amazing, you know, hockey and life experiences, you know, in Europe, in South America, Australia. So a number of different countries that we were traveling to and competing against, you know, the best teams in the world, which is ultimately what it's all about. And then finally, sort of coming toward, missed out on the 2002 World Cup, unfortunately. But all during this time as well, I was very involved in the indoor hockey, which my dad had been also pretty instrumental in terms of, South Africa's, indoor hockey history. So he's he coached the Springboks in 1985 against Ireland, and then subsequently with Greg Dark, they put together a touring side in 97 to go and play some indoor in the European Championships, and then we repeated in 1999, 2001, and with different teams, and off the back of having participated in those various tournaments, we then subsequently got an opportunity to represent South Africa at the first ever Indoor World Cup in Leipzig, Germany, in 2003. Also played with Juan in that tournament, and my old man was the chef de mission, I suppose, for the South African team, which is also another great shared family experience. And then, it all culminated with Athens. And I think not also to discount another pretty epic tournament that we played in, which was the Olympic qualifier in Madrid in Spain, which was also at the time when there was that Madrid bomb blast. And the pressure of having to come seventh to claim the final spot and going to strokes against Belgium. And clinching it. So some really incredible international hockey highlights. And then a little bit later on in 2014, also a hockey experience that was very unexpected, but ended up as you would know, and maybe some of the listeners would know, but ended up player coaching the Peninsula side at IPT 2014, and winning the tournament. So some great and fond hockey memories and some great friendships built along the way.
Yes, Steve, great to have you on the show. Derek here. Thanks for
How's it, Derek?
Great, man. Thank you so much for that very detailed intro. But I mean, we're going to go into quite some depth for a couple of those incidents that you did mention. But I want to go back. You speak about making your debut. There's no question as a sporting person, you want to go on to represent your country, no matter your vocation or which sport you have set your mind and ability to. So that must have been a great feeling. But moreover, the fact that you made your debut in India must have been even more special.
Absolutely, we were playing in the Chief Minister's Cup in Chennai, which was I think it's now Chennai. It used to be called Madras, down on the southeast coast of India. And we're staying in this hotel, and literally from arriving at the airport, there was just this incredible like atmosphere. You know, there were people waiting for us to get off the plane. You know, you'd have to sort of sidle your way through these fans to get to the bus. You know, everywhere you went, people were smiling and waving and pointing and just. You know, I guess it's what most of our international sports stars in other codes like football and cricket and so on experience on a day-to-day basis. But just to have that, where in a hockey context, we don't generally sort of experience that too much, and certainly not back then when it was still very very amateur. Or very much more amateur than perhaps what the current has experienced. But India, very special place, difficult place to tour. But my debut was against Bangladesh, and we ended up winning 5-0, which was a great start. And then we finished second to India in what was also a pretty amazing experience, playing against the likes of Dan Roche Pillay and a whole lot of other Indian legends.
Yeah, you speak about the fact that you played against Bangladesh in your first game up. I mean, that must have been a massive coup too, being able to capture the win, your first match, and to do so thoroughly. I mean, 5-0 is nothing to lift your nose at.
No, exactly. It was, I think you can't really ask for a better opportunity to kind of ease yourself into it. I know Sydney, like, you know, if you were playing in a massive game first up, there's already so many nerves, and you know, you've obviously hyped yourself up for this particular experience. So just to be able to ease in, to not quite have that same intensity and pressure, just meant that one could, you know, settle in, realize that actually the game's not, it's not a different game. It's not, you know, it's not significant it is significant in the sense of the value that you place in it, but it's no different to any other game. It's still hockey. You just got slightly less time and space to make your decisions.
Yeah, Steve, and obviously, I mean, your career obviously ended at the end of the Olympic Games. I mean, that must have been a rather special occasion to go and bow out at.
Yeah, it was. It's an interesting one. I think you know, certainly, like, my hockey career probably could have continued on further than that. But at the time, I'd made the decision with my wife to that, you know, after Athens, that we would call it a day. We ended up going back to the UK for one more season to focus on, you know, earning some money to set ourselves up. And so absolutely, you know, no regrets. And it was a great tournament to be involved in, and a great sort of pinnacle to be able to, yeah, to end a career on. So yeah, it was, yeah, right up there is definitely one of the most amazing life experiences, of course.
And we ask all the guys and girls that come on the program, on the podcast, we ask you, you know, specifically those who are the Olympians. I mean, just how special is it to be an Olympian? And did you get any of those starstruck moments when you bumped into some superstar in the village?
So it's a great question, actually. I think there's probably a few different facets to maybe unpack here. The first one is that, I mean, as a global, you know, sporting festival, it is absolutely the pinnacle. And I think the most incredible thing is that, for one, everybody has spent their entire lives, and certainly the previous 4 years, preparing themselves to be part of this epic sporting festival. The second thing is that you realize when you're in the village, and the food halls are the main sort of, I suppose, focal point, because, you know, you're needing to eat sort of 4 or 5 times a day. And so there's always a buzz around the eating halls. And of course, this is where you also get to engage and meet and chat to, you know, these other amazing superstars. So as an example, like, you may be standing in Athens. I was lucky enough to meet Frankie Fredericks. I met Michael Johnson. I was standing in the food queue next to Martina Navratilova. And so, you know, those are just a handful. Bekele, the long distance gold medalist and the 10,000 meters, you know, there were a number of just incredible athletes that, yeah, that it got to engage with. And a little sort of side story on that is, when you go to the games, you have to wear an accreditation, which is like an ID card that tells you, you know, where you can go and what you're allowed to do. And so I knew from having participated in other events that, it's always a good idea to take some little South African pins that you can trade. So as early as back in, you know, that first experience that I was sharing earlier about having gone to watch the 92 Olympics, at every Olympic Games, they release different limited edition pins that you know, would stick on a felt board or on your blazer or whatever the case may be. And so I'd been collecting pins from the 92 Olympics. And so I knew, to take a whole lot with me. And then essentially what I was doing is I was just swapping with different athletes that I would meet. And it actually ended up becoming quite a good way to like engage with other athletes, because I'd have stuck to my accreditation. There would be maybe, 13 or 14 different pins. And then I would have an extra couple in my pockets. And then, people would have a look and they'd be interested. And then, it's just a talking point to start the conversation. So, absolutely, on that front, incredible to be able to engage with and meet superstars. You also realize that they're just people. They're very down to earth. They at the same tournament as you are, competing for the same thing, which is a gold medal. And so it's a very sort of not odd experience, but where we build up these superstars so much because of what we see in the media. Ultimately, they're people just like you and I, and it's great to have that opportunity to meet them in a relatively relaxed environment.
Steve, that's amazing, and you had all these pins, and you're engaging with superstars of the sporting world, and is that what led to numerous conversations? You mentioned Michael Johnson. Was that just because you're behind him in the queue looking for a burger, or did he actually come to you and say, "Listen, how do I get in on this pin action?"
No, the Michael Johnson one was quite a funny one because I think one of the beauties of hockey, and in particular hockey teams, is that especially in the multi-code festivals or Commonwealth Games, Olympics, etc., is within the South African team, the rest of the athletes that are often competing individually, like the swimmers or smaller teams or the athletes, they are drawn into the fact that there's 16 or 18 guys or girls that already have got an identity, and they've got the banter and, the fun that goes on, like when you're on tour. So in the hockey team, we had a number of very, very colorful characters, like Dave Staniforth, who was the center of most shenanigans and bits and pieces that went down. But we actually, Dave had instituted a sort of a thanks for coming award, which ended up being a t-shirt that he'd made, where he'd got a caricature of Dave Carr, our manager, on the back of the shirt. And so at the end of the day, if you'd made a mistake or you'd been involved in, fall into a prank or somehow, been assigned or got nominated for the Thanks for Coming Award, you had to put the Dave Carr t-shirt on. And then you had to do effectively like a Russian sort of dance while the guys would all, sing and clap the Thanks for Coming song. So what we decided is that when we got to the Olympics and we're in the village and we realized there were all these amazing superstars, is we decided that when you got given the award, what you had to do is you had to actually return the following day to present the award to the next person that got it, but you had to have had it signed by a famous athlete. So when I got it, I ended up cornering Michael Johnson, and I got him to sign it and took some photographs with him. And of course, again, because there was a lot of people would just be captivated by what would happen. So invariably, we'd do the award ceremony, not in the confines of our little hostel or block of flats where we were staying, but actually in the food hall, of course, so that there's more embarrassment for the person getting it, and there's always curious onlookers. So yeah, lots of fun and games.
That's amazing. Good stories. We do a host of different quizzes and interviews, and about 2 months back, we had as our guest Brandon Stone, the South African golf who plays in the European Tour, and he represented South Africa at Rio. So the last Olympics and the golfing tournament there. And he told us an amazing story. He said that, you know, you're still trying to get over jet lag. So he woke up at around 2 a.m. or something. And he said, you know, what can I do to get this out of my system? Oh, the best way to do it is to head off to the gym. So that's what he did. And he said the gym was quiet. And he went in and so he got on the treadmill and he's running and he's not really paying attention to anything around him. And he's in his own little world listening to music. And he's jogging, and the next thing, he feels a presence to the left of him. The person's there, and the person's sprinting and going at like 12, 15 Ks an hour. And he's like just going along in his little gallop at about 6 or 7. And he feels a bit intimidated. He ups the ante slightly. And, geez, and this person next to him carries on. He just hears a doof, 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 doof. Eventually turns to have a look, and it's none other than Serena Williams.
Wow. So amazing.
It's amazing the stories that emanate from the Olympics. And I mean, if you look at your CV and you said, yeah, maybe you could have done a bit more, but that's certainly not the case. I think anyone who has aspirations to represent their country across any sport to have achieved what you've achieved in your career, people would have taken that hands down.
Yeah, absolutely. Two quick thoughts. The first one is I was reminded actually when you mentioned running on the treadmill. In this case, I was on an exercise bike. But John Eales actually was like a team ambassador for wow. Team Australia. Also, sort of just yeah, and I ended up having a long chat with him on the treadmill. And actually, I had met him previously when we were on a tour in Australia. Where, because his kids were big hockey fans, he came down to one of the tournaments and we got to meet him after the game. So then there was already like a recognition because, you know, introduced myself again and then subsequently actually saw him a couple of times during the games. But also just, you know, so incredible because for such an incredible sporting icon, he was essentially like solicited by, you know, Team Australia to just be on hand, to be there to talk with their Australian athletes, to inspire them, to just to help them with you know, the mental side of their game, how they're feeling, you know, just and he's such a legend, so down to earth, and just a great man.
And of course, that would have been in 2004, which was 4 years after Australia hosted it when it took place in Sydney. So he would have been a massive presence back then. So him and I played the same position. We actually had the same numbers on our backs. And he was always the guy that I looked up to as one that I wanted to try and emulate. And I remember because in 2000, he was involved when they talk about the greatest game of rugby ever played. It was a Bledisloe Cup test, and it was between New Zealand and the Wallabies, and the All Blacks just cracked it right at the death. I think it was Jonah Lomu who got the try. But John Eales, no doubt, would have been a massive factor and inspiration back in 2000. And it's amazing the foresight that Australians have, because even looking back at the 2000 Olympics, if we go back even further back to 1996, and the Australians were absolutely obliterated across all sporting codes, at the Olympics, they came almost nowhere in the medals, and they came about a plan. They said, look, we're hosting the Olympics in 4 years' time, and we need to get our act together. We can't be an embarrassment as hosts. And, I mean, the proof is in the pudding. I think they came second, if I'm not mistaken, on the medals table, in 2000, which was a world away from where they'd come, 4 years earlier. And you mentioned, I mean, what would a rugby player be doing within an Olympic squad 4 years later when rugby wasn't even on the cards? I mean, this day and age would probably be fairly understandable. But even then, I mean, a lock playing sevens rugby is unheard of. So, it blows my mind, the foresight that had to have. And incidentally, and I don't know, he'll say it's not true, but everyone else pretty much acknowledges it. So I don't know if you know it, but John Eales' nickname
was
nobody. Yes. Because nobody's perfect.
Because nobody's perfect. Yeah.
What a legend.
He had a good chuckle about that because obviously the guys, you know, he always asked him and said, you know, like, what is it about your nickname? And he just shrugs it off. But he's such a legend and a very down to earth guy.
Mm.
But, but it was, I must say as well, just sort of rewinding a little bit from that sort of 2004 moment, as I alluded to in that very long introduction, one of my sort of great sporting experiences, I suppose, although unfortunately it wasn't on the playing side, but having heard we weren't going to go to Sydney, I ended up deciding that I was going to be there no matter what. You know, we'd invested so much time, energy, effort, you know, to qualify and to and you know, set on going. And so anyway, my brother had actually been on a gap year in Oz in Perth in 99. And so he just connected me with a couple of the schools where he'd been involved. And I went out there for a couple of months, played in the Classic League against all of the guys that, you know, were in the Australian squad, because their sort of center of excellence is in Perth. So all the Olympic teams were there training and playing every day. And then I went across to Sydney, and I was staying on the floor of an old varsity friend of mine who had volunteered to do some of the stats associated with hockey. And then some business commitments came up. So literally like the week before I arrived in Sydney, and I'd asked Roger Gordon to sort of buy me some tickets. So all the money that I'd sort of earned in the course of working at one of the schools, I was then going to spend on hockey tickets. Subsequently was able to, because Chris phoned me up and he said, listen, like he's got this business commitment, he can't fulfill this volunteer position. You know, can you substitute for me? And I was like, well, hell yeah. So anyway, ended up getting accredited as a volunteer, and then worked 25 out of the 78 games, because we knew all the Olympic athletes. So we knew obviously all the women's hockey and a couple of other sporting codes that we'd met previous qualifiers and so on. Ended up, you know, being signed into the athlete hospitality area. And then my wife and I actually ended up, you know, being in there for the, and experienced in Olympic Park for the 16 days of the Olympics. And it was pretty hardcore. It was a bit like 16 New Years in a row, because you'd go in the morning, you'd check in, you'd either go and watch, some live events if you had tickets. Otherwise, you could go in and you could watch the live feeds in the athlete hospitality area. And Sydney Olympic Park was still, from my experience of the three Olympics that I went to, in Barcelona was a bit sort of sprawled out across the city. But Olympic Park in Sydney was a purpose-built venue with all the different sporting codes there. You had 2 million people a day in Olympic Park, so you actually have to have a valid ticket or accreditation to be able to be inside Olympic Park. And then the main boulevard, which probably extended about, I don't know, it goes past the Telstra Stadium there, and it was probably about, you know, maybe 4 or 5 Ks long boulevard. And at lunchtime, there would just be, you know, maybe 20, 25 people walking abreast for 4 kilometers, all you could see, you know. Just this incredible, incredible sporting experience. Yeah, and then we got to pretty much, just experience the games. And like I said, in the end, ended up sitting on the gold medal match between Korea and Holland. And experiencing a gold medal match, an Olympic final, basically from the bench. Really cool.
That almost makes you John Wright.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, look, Sebs, obviously, then we go a little bit further post your playing and volunteering days and stuff. And there was a massive call from a lot of people because of your hockey mind to see you getting involved in the SA coaching. You did become the assistant coach with Fabian Gregory for a period of time. But there were even calls when Fabian left for you to take the head coach role over yourself. I mean, why did you not, or did you put your name forward, or yeah? And is it something you could see yourself doing in the future? Because obviously, we've seen your coaching at PHL, at IPT, and of course, player coach, as you said earlier, when the Pens became the first ever B team to win the IPT. So your pedigree's there, the players respect you. Is it something that you'd want to do or not?
Yeah, I think what one has to weigh up in making these decisions is you know, what cost does that opportunity come at? And I say what cost in the sense of the realities of life. So in my case, I have my own business interests, and it's not, yeah, in the technology space and the online space. You know, if you're going to embark and you're going to go down a path that is, you know, full is the head coach of the South African team, you're weighing up you know, the financial considerations of taking on that role. I know that is, you know, from all the other coaches that have preceded me, you know, the conversations that we often have are around, you know, what is my role as a coach? Is it just coaching, or is it coaching and fundraising? And to that point, you know, you have to look at the requirements and the effort that you're going to be putting in the context of your day job, I suppose. Because yeah, I don't think that it would really be able to be done on a full-time basis from a, you know, financial position.
Yeah, so, and obviously yes, that. Sorry, I was just going to interject there. And obviously,
no, sure.
I mean, I want to add to that, or add your thoughts there. I mean, what does South Africa do? Well, you're answering. What does South Africa need to do? Yeah, you know, we're far away from having a professional hockey structure. You know, there'd be a lot of things that need to change or stuff, and a lot of partners would have to come on board. But surely we could get to a point where we can have at least a full-time coach who is remunerated for the role.
Yeah, look, I think the tricky sort of part of South African sport is that we don't have as much governmental support as perhaps in other countries, which obviously means that when it comes to weighing up the you know, the financial considerations of not only running a team, but also support, you know, the support staff, the administration that goes along with it. Yeah, essentially, I think, you know, we have started down the right path, you know, with PHL, and where the rights packages are being put together, correctly and are being sold. And I think we do sit in a unique situation where, you know, as far as I'm aware, I think hockey is the fastest growing sport in South Africa, just simply because of our school kids and the fact that it's both boys and girls. And so now what we have to do is we have to translate, you know, that viewership and that into dollars ultimately, or brands as the case may be.
Steve, so from extreme highs to very, very deep lows. So you retired from the game. I mean, that must have been tough as is. And then you were stricken with cancer.
So post Athens and post retiring, I then sort of threw all my energy into the business side of things. And as a structural engineer, I ended up working for a year abroad in the UK, and then subsequently for another 2 years when we came back to South Africa. But I was a bit frustrated by the fact that it would take, you know, so long to get to the business side of engineering, you know, sort of a 20-year path to become a director of a company and so on and so forth. So I ended up joining a little startup niche management consultancy startup. And we ended up doing quite a lot of offshore consulting in the Middle East and in India. So lucky to go back and experience India again. But I think it was managing multi-million dollar projects from Cape Town, being on a plane every other month for like a week at a time. And just, you know, being in that sort of, you know, when you're in market, working 16 hours a day. So absolutely, the cancer came as a big shock. It was 2010. It was just testicular cancer. Luckily, because our family's pretty medically orientated, you know, the screening, which is what a lot of our female listeners would be familiar with in terms of their breast screening and the process that they get educated and taught about. When it comes to men, you should be screening your testicles in the same way, which just means having a feel in the shower and just feeling for changes, for lumps. And, you know, and that's actually quite good timing now that we have Movember starting this on next week. And it is obviously, you know, men's testicular cancer and prostate cancer awareness month. So yeah, it was a very interesting time. My wife was 8 months pregnant with our second child at the time. And my daughter was two at that time. And, it gave me a pretty good, time to reflect on, you know, lifestyle. And in particular, I think what you realize is that you need to look after your body. Your body can only handle a certain amount or a finite amount of stress. And it's absolutely, I believe it was the lifestyle and the travel, and the intense pressure that I was operating under, which resulted in the cancer. What I can say though is, as by a stroke of very good luck, having picked up this lump, we took action very quickly and very early, which meant that it was a much easier road in terms of recovery and beating cancer than if you take, for example, like the Lance Armstrong story, where he only picked it up once it was already, you know, stage three, and had gotten to his lungs, and then subsequently came back and went actually into his head, into his brain as well. The good news is that in this day and age, we have the diagnostic tools, we have the support, and you absolutely can recover and you can beat it, you know.
Sorry, I was on mute and I was talking. Proper 2020 behavior there. Yeah, I mean, and Steve, I mean, if you were to chat to youngsters, you know, because you were fairly young when you were diagnosed with cancer, I mean, and those who are feeling pretty defeated by the fact that they have got cancer, I mean, what would your advice be to those suffering?
Yeah, look, absolutely. The most important thing that I believe in life is having a positive mindset. Now, that's probably easier said than done in many cases, and so as a result, in the cancer journey, much like in your hockey journey, I suppose, it's your support network that ultimately are the most important things and people to have around you, because every day is not going to be a good day. And it's at times when you're feeling uncertain, when you don't quite know what the path ahead holds for you, that is where you need to turn to your mentors, to your support network. And that is why, in the cancer journey, those support groups are so important, because it's people like you and I that are experiencing that same disease and are going through that process of learning more about their bodies and what you need, what it needs to take to beat the disease.
Yeah, and I mean, if you do look back at your life, obviously you become your parents, your kids will look at you, and obviously a lot of the schools you talk to as well. I mean, I suppose the overcoming of the hurdles in your life, you know, from a political point of view, if you've been blocked from going to the Olympics, you made your way there, you got cancer, you overcame it. I mean, would you say that is the characteristic hallmark of who Steve Evans is?
Yeah, a fighter, I guess. Yeah, I think definitely, you know, goal-driven, enjoy the challenges that, you know, that life throws at you. But, yeah, as I always say to my kids, like, you got to remember to live every day, and you got to remember to enjoy the journey, because literally, you know, that Olympic experience, which one had worked one's whole life towards, was gone in the click of the fingers, you know? So you just have to make sure that, every day, every step that you take, you know, along the path, that you are celebrating the small wins, that you are connecting with people, and enjoying, every experience, both good and bad, along the way.
Yeah, it's an incredible inspiration.
Not enjoying, savoring every experience.
Yeah, no, very, very well put. It really is an incredible journey that you have undertaken, and as mentioned, from the highs to the lows, but you have come out relatively unscathed. And we spoke about CVs, and you certainly have a glowing one to look back on. And despite the advent that cerebral scourge that is cancer, you have managed to overcome it, which many people have not, unfortunately. Steve, it's been fantastic chatting to you, and really, really engaging. I love the depth that you go to in terms of your answers, because, yeah, I mean, I could listen for hours. Unfortunately, we have come near to the end, but before we go, I'm sure you are familiar with the show, and we do finish off with the dreaded, or some might say much loved, one question quiz, although pretty much no one says that these days. Let me find something nice segue that can... Oh, here we go.
Golazo! Golazo! Obviously, I'm not going to tell you the right answer, because you'll never know whether I'm actually being honest or not. whether I know the answer or not.
Okay.
We'll start the mind games now, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so it's a nice easy one, Steve. So... if you've listened to the show before, usually what happens is that we incorporate a question related to a couple of specific subjects, and I'm going the way of one of the more popular theories that we go along. I want to know, there's a Scottish former footballer who became a manager, and he bears the exact same name as you do, Steve Evans, born in 1962, played for a couple of clubs, but he managed even more. And he managed a club, out of all the ones that he managed, that is currently in the Premier League. I want to know which club that is.
Sure. I'd be probably having a flyer, but, I'd probably go with maybe like a Leeds United, obviously not drawing on any technology or, you know, tools that might assist. But yeah, I'd probably go with maybe like a Leeds or an Aston Villa. Golazo! Golazo! Am I way off the mark?
Not at all. You 100% spot on. He did manage Leeds United when they weren't in the Premier League, of course. That was courtesy of Marcelo. What's it, Bielsa? But he managed them from 2015 to 2016 when they were still in the championship, before he went off to...
No ways.
Mansfield Town. But, you did get that spot on. Well done. And, I think the few in the past that have managed to get it right, have largely been aided by us. But there was absolutely no assistance whatsoever from your side. And, yeah, one of the few people to get it 100% spot on, all by themselves. Well done.
Thank you. Thank
you. Oh, Steve, man, it's been such a pleasure chatting to you. Really, really great. Where are you based, by the way?
I'm Downing. So yeah, involved at Province Cricket Club, and lucky enough to live just down the road from Greg Clark, so I see him a fair bit. A lot of old hockey friends that are that I get to engage with and play with on the weekends. Obviously not COVID, but very, very blessed to live in Cape Town and to have a great group of mates to play the game I love with.
You speak about cricket, Province Cricket Club. I don't know if you've heard, we chatting to you on the Friday, the day after the new name was revealed, or the new sponsor's name was revealed for the Cape Cobras. Did you hear what it is?
I didn't, actually.
So get ready for this. It's a bit of a mouthful. And once again, we thank the sponsors for coming on board, though, because we must make that clear. In this day and age, money is very hard to come by. So sponsors that are willing to get behind teams is very appreciated. But yeah, it's a bit of a long one. They are officially called the Six Gun Grill Cape Cobras.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's cool. From the Six Gun Grill seasoning. So it's a tongue twister, but they do have some money now, yeah, which is welcome.
But Derek, at the same time, I'm more than willing to welcome you all to the Six Gun Grill Hockey the Podcast.
We'll take it. And you can throw in the seasoning for us. So you don't need to hide that word. You can call it the Six Gun Grill Seasoning Hockey the Podcast. We'll take it.
For sure.
Steve, shot so much. Thanks for the time. I know you are a busy man as well with your job and kids and stuff, so we appreciate the time. And I'm pretty sure Ian got the question wrong. And
that's perfect. Bragging rights for the rest of life. So yeah. I'll be sure to let him know 100%.
Awesome, man. Have a great weekend. Obviously, when all of you are listening to this, have a great week. We look forward to seeing you around the hockey field, and hopefully once we can travel again, we'll meet up for a cold beverage down in Cape Town.
Yeah, and also, guys, I think on behalf of the hockey community, I'm sure everyone probably has said it before, but what you guys are doing in terms of creating the media for our young aspiring hockey players and hockey lovers to consume is such an important part of the process. And so, yeah, just a big hats off to you guys for all the time, energy, effort that you put into helping make our game greater and better. So, yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, but also, yeah, well done on a great product.
Thank you so much, Steve, and really, really appreciate it, and really appreciate you giving of your time to chat with us over this last hour and a bit. Listen, have a great weekend. For the folks that will be listening, they'll be getting this on a Tuesday, so have a great week. But this was recorded a few days earlier, and it is a Friday as we head into the afternoon. Plenty of cold beers await for you over in the beautiful city of Cape Town, and we'll catch up soon, Steve.
Super. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers, go well.
Lovely stuff, Ty. A great guest as always.
Yeah, Derek, do we ever not have great guests? But of course, Steve is right up there. He is someone who many, many people would love to see at the helm of the national team one day. And who knows, maybe one day it could happen. But for now, anyone who at least chats some hockey with him will be benefiting from it.
Yeah, no, there's no question. I mean, even if you don't know him, or if you don't really know the sport of hockey, if you just literally tuned in for 10 minutes, you can quickly gauge that this guy has a hockey brain through and through. First as a player, and next as an administrator, a coach. So there's certainly a veritable wealth of hockey information loaded within that brain. And South Africa will do very, very nicely to make use of that knowledge.
Yeah, Derek, and just on a side note, I mean, I know Steve was an ex-indoor international. I will be commentating on Saturday night, so by the time you listen to this, it'll be in the past. But for the first time since COVID had happened, the SA Indoor Hockey Men playing a few exhibition games against the under-23s in Mpumalanga. and it'll just be nice to go be on the side of the court. As far as I know, it is not open to the public, so it will be being streamed. And for that reason, I get to go be behind the mic for the first time in 11 months, which is quite exciting.
Oh, man, that works out perfectly. Very, very jealous because I know how much fun I had commentating alongside you in Durban last year. But hopefully we do get more and more events coming through in the future where the public can come and watch as well. But great news to hear that these games will be streamed. So, hopefully, like as mentioned, when it does come out, it will have already happened. But I'm sure they can get rebroadcasts tied, you know?
Yeah, I think it's live on YouTube, so it's okay. Probably you can go watch it later.
Perfecto. That's magnificent. Well, Ty, thanks so much as always. Well done with another fantastic guest. Another episode done and dusted of Hockey the Podcast. We'll catch you in a week's time. Ciao.